The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This episode will attempt to shed some light on how animals do some of the amazing things they do. We'll be speaking a little later to anthropologist Greg Layden about some recent developments in the study of crow cognition. But first, let's look at the research around how animals are able to cross miles of land, water, and sky, seemingly without a map. My guest is James Gould, an ethologist, someone who seeks to reverse engineer the programming of animal minds. James has worked on organisms from homing pigeons to whales, including honeybees, in particular the dance language controversy. One of the high points of his research was laying out what is now the widely accepted theory of how animal GPS works. He's the co-author of the book Nature's Compass, The Mystery of Animal Navigation. Welcome to the show, James.
Glad to be here.
Now, I have been fascinated by this topic for years, and I know I'm not alone. But many of the first theories about animal navigation seem to be either overly simplistic or rather anthropomorphic. So can you maybe give us some background on some of those early theories?
Well, the earliest theory was that animals got where they were going by chance. And that if you took 100 homing pigeons away and released them, of course one or two would get back because they'd just fly at random until they encountered their loft. But more serious study made it clear that they knew a great deal more. And so there have been a variety of wonderful ideas, one involving the Coriolis force of the Earth as a way of measuring latitude, or being able to see the sun through the clouds, or being able to detect mysterious forces emanating from the universe. And there's just been a variety. My favorite is the idea that olfaction is the key, so that an animal that travels 10,000 miles somehow gets there by following its nose, just sniffing the air and saying, that smells like where I'm supposed to be. So the actual explanation turns out to be just as incredible as all of the ones that turned out to be wrong.
Well, now, this is a tremendously difficult thing to study, from what I understand from your book.
Yes, well, you need lots of animals and lots of patience.
Then why is it so difficult, exactly?
Well, the main thing is our imaginations. We tend to assume animals are simple and do things in simple ways. And so, for example, if you show that a pigeon doesn't need the sun to home, then clearly it doesn't use the sun. But, of course, that turns out to be wrong. It's their favorite cue. It's just if you take it away, they move to a backup. And if you take the backup away, they move to their second backup. It's just like a NASA space shuttle. There are a whole series of layers, so if something goes wrong, with any luck, the next layer will pick it up and take care of it. So you take away one cue from, well, a honeybee, a homing pigeon, any animal. It substitutes something else. It's less preferred cue, but one it can still work by. And the failure of imagination also goes as to the question of what things animals can sense. So, for example, they can see polarized light, many of them, which we can't see, we're blind to. And so it was very hard for people to imagine that animals could. They see in the ultraviolet, they can sense magnetic fields, they can do any number of things that seem to us just impossible. So our failure of imagination is both in terms of how they're programmed, the number of layers they have, and what they can sense that we can't. We used to think that humans were the benchmark of animal sensation, and now we know that actually we just have a collection of things we're good at and that lots of things we just simply can't do because we can't pick up the cues.
Is this one of those fields that's been helped along by improvements in technology, or did we just start asking different, possibly better questions?
I think probably the discovery that bats could hear ultrasonic sounds was one of the key things. The discovery that bees, and this is a long time ago, in the late 40s, could see polarized light and ultraviolet light. Again, that, I think, began to shake up people, and they started looking for mysterious cues, and that's where Coriolis force came in briefly. But magnetic fields are probably the most mysterious of all. I still remember my thesis advisor, who was a world expert on navigation, expressing his complete contempt for anyone that could possibly imagine animals could sense the magnetic field of the Earth. And yet he's the one that discovered ultrasonic hearing in bats, so it's not like he didn't have the imagination, but that was just too far out on the fringe. And that turns out to be one of the things that many, many animals can sense and use.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with James Gould. He's the co-author of the book Nature's Compass, The Mystery of Animal Navigation. Okay, so you mentioned that there's not one orientation strategy that animals use, but a range of them, and some of them actually that humans use as well. And the most simple seems to be taxis. Can you tell us about that?
Well, taxis is just a simple ability to move either in a constant direction relative to a cue, like say 90 degrees to the right of the sun, or toward a cue, like the sun or heat or what have you. And it used to be thought that that's really all animals could do. They either had positive phototaxis or negative geotaxis or so on. And that view became impossible to hold after people discovered that many of the animals who were thought to only do taxis, like phototaxis, would actually begin moving toward the sun before they could sense it. It was clear that there was other stuff going on. And again, that was a lack of imagination. But people haven't talked seriously about taxis and kinesis and all that thing since, perhaps the 1930s. I think we've moved past that. Our limits on our imagination are further down the road than that.
Well, you say that built into the idea of navigation is an awareness of time.
Yes, that's right. For most cues, you need to know what time it is. So, for example, if you want to use the sun, which is the most popular compass among animals, you have to take into account what time of day it is, because the sun is in the east at dawn and the south at noon and the west later in the afternoon. So you have to have a time-compensated compass. And the same thing works for a number of other cues. Polarized light, for example, changes over the course of the day. So a lot of animals need time. Plus, if they're going to reconstruct a route, many animals do what we call dead reckoning. They keep track of the various legs of their journey out from home. Honeybees do this, homing pigeons do this as they go out to forage. And then when they decide it's time to go back, they don't recapitulate that journey. They calculate the straight line distance and direction. And to do that, the assumption has always been that they measure the time and direction and speed of each of the legs and then do some trigonometry. I was about to say simple trigonometry, but of course it's not simple. It's very complicated. And we know from quite a bit of work that they're actually a good deal better at this than we are. The question of their use of time, however, has recently been somewhat clouded by the discovery that quite a few animals actually don't bother to measure time. They're not very good at measuring time. We're terrible, about 30% off a typical guess of elapsed time. Though they actually count the number of steps or wing beats or tail flips and get distance that way. So, in fact, they have a much cleverer way of doing this triangulating to get back home than we do. We're just not designed to do it. Whereas for the animals for which this is a life and death proposition, they have special apps for dealing with this.
But that's the time of day. So that's the clock part, but it seems like they almost need a calendar as well.
They do. Animals anticipate the changing seasons and begin redeploying well before it's starting to get warmer or anything else where they intend to do their nesting. So, yes, they have to have an annual timer. There are lots of animals that also know the lunar cycle, the tidal cycle, and so on. So there are whatever you need, you have. We don't need it, so we don't have it.
Well, you mentioned the lunar cycles. Can you tell us about the fireworms?
Oh, the fireworms of Bermuda. Yes, well, these animals are little annelid worms, like earthworms, except they're aquatic. And they live in the mud, eating we're not quite sure what. But they have to find each other in order to mate. And so they've agreed that the perfect moment for mating is 3 days after the full moon, 55 minutes after the sun sets during the summer when the water is warm. So if you're in Bermuda and you happen to be there 3 days after the full moon, then you should go 55 minutes after sunset and look off a bridge, and you will see quite a show. Lasts for about 4 minutes, and then it's over for another 8 weeks, or 4 weeks rather, and then it happens again.
That is remarkably precise.
It is. It's and the thing is, every year, I've done this 8 years now with my marine biology students in Bermuda, and every year I begin having doubts about 2 minutes before they're supposed to start, but they always turn up. So clearly their faith in all of this is much stronger than mine.
I have to ask, are there any other species that run on these kind of interestingly strict deadlines?
Well, that's sort of the most dramatic that I know of. I'm sure there are none come to mind at this moment.
So back to the clock in the calendar. So is that two separate timers, or is that one timer then?
Oh, we all wonder that. Also, there's an elapsed timer, an ability to measure how many minutes since you started keeping track. And there's been a lot of debate about that, but I think the genetic evidence is now pretty clear from knockout mutations that while they use some of the same basic gears and wheels, they are independent. You can knock one out without affecting the other if you hit the right gene. So we believe that there's a series, and in fact, we believe that there are, in fact, two day timers located in different parts of the body, controlling different aspects of behavior. So there's one that actually is involved in orientation that's quite distinct from the one that tells your internal organs when to get hungry. So it turns out that, again, to be much more complicated than anybody was willing to think, or at least hope. If you think about it, science is really an act of faith. We believe that there's some order to the chaos around us and that we're smart enough to understand it. And nature is in the business of proving us wrong.
So then how exactly do we know that these timers exist?
Because you can take the animals away from all the cues that could be used to reset them, and they continue to behave in the same cycle. 24 hours, well, they're not great timers. 23 hours and 47 minutes later, or 25 hours and 12 minutes later, or whatever. The animal does whatever it did that time the previous day. And the next day, it does it again with the same kind of drift in its clock. They slowly drift out of phase with the world, and when you reimpose the cues, like sunrise or whatever, that they calibrate to, they very quickly get back. In other words, it's jet lag, and they adapt the same as we do. It takes 2 or 3 days if they're well out of sync, but they get back. Same thing with annual clocks. You can put birds in sensory isolation, and 12 months after they flew south for the winter, they'll start trying to get out of the south side of the cage. And 6 months later, they'll try to get out of the north side of the cage to head back to where they know they ought to be. Again, it drifts slowly out of phase because they're not perfect timers. But nevertheless, it's clear that they know in advance what they're supposed to be doing, what time of year, what day of the month, what hour of the day it is.
I know we use the sun and stars as clocks, but do animals?
Well, we use them, but only because we have tables and charts and things like that. Animals are born knowing how to use it. They do have to calibrate. They do have to take a look at the sky and see which way the sun moves. They might have been born in the southern hemisphere. And they have to see how fast it's moving, because it might be spring or fall. But it only takes a couple of days for them to get calibrated. And then they use all of these cues effortlessly. No charts, as I say, no big books of tables. They know exactly how to use it. They have a built-in app for it.
Now, when we say that an animal or an insect has a compass, what exactly does that mean?
Well, that means that they can pick out a direction. So whether it's relative to the sun or the polarized light in the sky or the Earth's magnetic field or whatever, they're able to hold a constant orientation with respect to it. And in the case of the sun and polarized light, they're able to compensate for the movement over the course of the day. So the exact direction they go, that depends on their need, what they've learned about where various things in their habitat are. But the ability to, knowing that you want to go, say, north-northeast for 140 yards, they look at the sky and they suddenly know which direction to go, and then they keep track of distance and they stop at the right place.
Well, now you mentioned using the sun as a compass. That can be problematic, correct?
That's right. The sun keeps moving, and not only that, its path through the sky depends on your latitude and the time of year. So if you had a table for today, it would be no use to you in 2 weeks. So, no, it's not easy.
Well, and some species also spend large amounts of time in complete darkness, so sun's not terribly helpful.
Well, and if you think about it, in fact, the vast majority of migrating birds migrate at night when there's no sun compass at all. So a lot of animals need to be able to do without it. Plus, if it's overcast, the honeybees and birds don't fall to the ground helpless and cry until the clouds go away. They soldier on using backup systems.
Well, now let's talk about some of these systems. You are an expert in how bees navigate, so tell us how that works.
Let's see. So if you're a bee, what you do is, first of all, you need to know where to go. So you attend a dance in the hive. It's really a little map of the path that the last bee took. Bee dances, does a little waggle dance, from which you get the direction and the distance. So you step outside, and the first thing is to figure out what direction you should be going relative to the sun, which is your main cue. And the dance tells you that, so you take up that direction and you head out. But if it's midsummer near noon, the sun will have moved while you were out foraging, so you need to compensate that for that on your way back. And let's say you're on the way back and the sun goes behind a cloud. What do you do? They switch automatically to using the patterns of polarized light in the sky, which are created by the interaction of photons from the sun and the blue sky. And if the clouds come over while you're out, you have to switch back to using the Earth's field, Earth's magnetic field. But you know, that at least doesn't go away. It may not be as accurate, but it doesn't go away if changes in the weather. So you're okay with that.
Well, and they don't just navigate to find their own way. They come back and they tell other bees.
Right. So they have this lovely dance, which is the second most complicated language in the animal world. The language we're using in this interview is number one by a fair margin. But bees are number two, and it just reminds us that the size of an animal or the number of supernumerary legs or whether or not its exoskeleton is crunchy or not is really no guide to how smart the animal is. The animal is as smart as it needs to be to make its living in its niche. And honeybees have discovered this sophisticated language in which they tell each other the distance and direction and also the quality of the food. And then the recruit bees, attending these dances in the darkness of the hive, decide which dance they've attended is really the best one, and they go out and look for that particular source of food. So the bees are much more efficient at recruiting than many of their competitors. Wasps, bumblebees, and the rest depend much more on chance. Honeybees actually draw a little map, so they exploit food much more efficiently than their competitors.
Well, how do they explain where the food is?
So the convention, and a language is just any set of symbols that is shared between individuals, that's used to describe events, distance, and space and time. At least that was the definition until the honeybee dance language was discovered, then linguists quickly reworked the definition to exclude the bees. But to be fair, I mean, this is definitely a language. So the convention is that they do the dances on vertical column in the hive. The convention is opposite the direction of the sun. So if I dance 45 degrees to the right of up in the hive, I'm saying that the food is 45 degrees to the right of the sun in the field. You go out, take a 45 degree right, and go. Now, how far do you go? Well, for that, you need to either count the number of waggles in the dance, they vibrate their body back and forth during this dance, or the amount of time spent waggling. And there are several parameters. They average all of this to get better accuracy. And the convention is, if you are an Italian honeybee, which are the yellow ones that we have here in the U.S., if you're an Italian bee, one waggles about 40 yards. Whereas if you're one of the dark-colored German subspecies of bees, one waggles about 100 yards. But if you were in Egypt and you were watching the dance of an Egyptian bee, a waggle would be about 10 yards. These are innate dialects of bees that are Italians are born knowing that it's supposed to be 40 meters, and we'll misunderstand the dances of German bees, and the Germans will misunderstand the Egyptians. So there's no learning to this. It's all dialects. But again, that's one of the aspects of language. And then if you measure the angle through which the waggling bee vibrates its body, that correlates very well with the quality of the food. So these three components are all encoded symbolically into this dance.
Okay, you said that it was innate and that it wasn't learned. Now, do you mean it wasn't learned between sort of subspecies, or that bees innately know how to do this?
It's like everything, a mixture of instinct and learning, but the learning is really calibration. It's figuring out which way the sun goes, how fast it goes at 11 a.m. in the day versus 10 a.m. versus 9 a.m., storing that information. So that's learning, but it's a very programmed sort of learning in which the animal knows in advance what it's supposed to learn and how it's supposed to use this information later. So they arrive with kind of a default set of values, but they quickly get the details right. So the language is both innate and learned, but the learning is a kind of learning that is very instinctual, and in fact it's very similar to most of the learning we see in the wild. We kind of romanticize learning, so animals decide what they're going to learn about and figure out how to use the information. This is nonsense. Animals would all be dead if they depended on their own wits to figure out what to learn. No, they come knowing what they're supposed to pay attention to and what they're supposed to ignore. So, for example, if we're teaching honeybees to recognize a flower, and they're very good at this because they specialize on particular flowers, if we're trying to teach them, they will learn the odor, and they will learn the color, and they will learn the shape, but they will not learn the polarization angle. Even though no animal in the world is more sensitive to polarization angle, it's just they know innately that this is not relevant information, and they're not supposed to learn it. And there's a whole list of things that they refuse to learn in the context of navigation or flower learning or what have you, that they learn in other contexts just fine. It's just they know, don't waste your time with this. It's irrelevant. And that makes for a bee that learns more reliably and faster than a bee that just comes naive to the situation and is trying to figure it out de novo.
And we'll be back to talk more with James Gould, co-author of the book Nature's Compass, The Mystery of Animal Navigation, after these brief messages.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. My guest today is ethologist James Gould, who's done three programs for the BBC Horizon series and published 20 papers between the journals Science and Nature, and this is his 10th book, of which he's the co-author, and that's Nature's Compass, The Mystery of Animal Navigation. Now, you've been involved in quite a large amount of research that backs all of this up, correct?
Well, the honeybee work, of course, is what I've spent most time on, working out their navigational system and their learning and their ability to do things we'd call cognitive, insight, generalization, and so on. The general result of that has basically been that every time we find the bees can do something that humans can do that we used to think was very cognitively challenging, like draw little mental maps in the mind to formulate novel routes, or recognize, be able to generalize things like symmetrical versus asymmetrical, and so on. As we've discovered that bees can do this too, we've generally decided that they're not that cognitive in humans either. So the list of really smart things humans do has been shortened by the number of things animals do. And when you do your piece on the crows, be sure to ask the researcher if that hasn't been the pattern with bird cognition too. The smarter birds get, the stupider humans seem to be. We are very reluctant to give other animals credit for the things that we used to think were so special in us. That's not to say we aren't very smart. It's just we're not as smart as we have thought. We're a lot more the product of our genes than is convenient to think. The other animal that I'm, the animals that I'm very interested in are the ones that can either home or migrate. So honeybees operate in a very small scale, a few square miles. And if you take a bee, kidnap it and take it away within its flight range, it flies around and very quickly figures out where it is. It has a mental map, a so-called cognitive map, and it goes home. But if you take it outside of its home range, then it's completely lost. But this is not true for homing pigeons or sea turtles or a wide variety of animals, almost any species of migrating bird. You can interrupt them during their migration and take them away in sensory isolation, 1,000, or in the case of one experiment done here in Princeton, 3,000 miles. The birds were captured in Washington State as they flew south from Canada to Baja, California. They were flown in sensory isolation to Princeton. They were released, and guess what? They sort of looked stunned for a bit and then set off in the right direction. That is to say, to Baja, California, which no longer was south, but now was southwest. Birds intercepted in flights across Europe and taken into Siberia turn and fly back to the destination. So they know where they are. Homing pigeons are the most famous because you don't have to wait for migration. You can do this any time of the year that it's warm enough. You just collect them in the loft, take them out in sensory deprivation, turn them loose. They circle a couple of times and they head off toward home. So these animals I find especially interesting because they must have either some really clever way of measuring where you've taken them, and so clever that nobody has been able to figure out what cue it is that you need to deprive them of, or, which is much more likely, they have an internal map, a GPS. And certainly the birds that you kidnap and take 3,000 miles away and release, the fact that they head toward where they intended to go in the first place tells us that that's really true. Birds that set off with no experience whatsoever and fly 11,000 miles across the Pacific to a particular set of islands must have a map or the species would have gone extinct many years ago. Monarch butterflies, which fly from all over North America back to Mexico, where only their great-great-grandmothers had been, are able to arrive in a little tiny mountainous area, smaller than the Princeton campus, with extraordinary precision. So if these animals don't have a map, they are doing something that really is beyond our imagination. But happily, we know they do have a map because there are cues you can take away, and they no longer can do it. But more convincing than that, I mean, you always, you know, take away some cues, the animals can't do it. They always can think of other ways to get around it. What's really convincing is that you can take them and just put them in a box, all right? Not take them anywhere at any distance, just put them in a box, dial up magnetic coordinates into the box, and now that you're giving them the magnetic coordinates 3,000 miles away, and the animals turn and try to get the direction they ought to be going. So they're completely fooled. It's our sea turtles in particular, but also newts and lobsters and a variety of other animals. Flying animals are very difficult, but ones that have to swim or walk are much more convenient.
And there have been some other potential perspectives on pigeons as well. You wrote about one that suggested that they might be using smell as a cue.
Back when we were really desperate for a theory, some Italian researchers found that smell could be important. This was very curious, and that it's very difficult to imagine how long-distance migrators could use odors as cues. But the theory of the pigeons was that the pigeons in the loft sniff the air when it comes from the north and take a deep breath when it comes from the east and from the south and so on, and they slowly build up this map of, ooh, it always smells like pine when the wind is from the north and so on. And then they showed that if you then interfere with their ability to sense odors, they are very bad at getting home. But now, two things have happened. first of all, these birds are not reared the way normal pigeons are reared. Normal pigeons fledge at about 6 weeks of age, and they start flying around their home area, aloft in the case of birds that are kept by fanciers or wherever they are building their nests. They're colonial birds. They like living on cliffs. They start flying around, and after a few weeks, you can carry them away and release them, and they fly back home. So the real question is, does confining the birds in the loft for their entire lives, which is the way these olfactory experiments are done, so that they never have this period of flying around the loft when they might be learning something, does that matter? And the answer is, it certainly does. If you don't give the birds experience, it turns out they can't use the sun compass, they can't use polarized light, and they can't use the Earth's magnetic field. You can, by giving them this incredibly deprived kind of lifestyle, something that, you know, if you found a child being treated this way, locked in the closet until it was age six, you would be outraged. But the pigeons, they don't seem to be able to complain. If you raise them in this incredibly deprived way, in fact, they do memorize the odors coming from different directions. It's just in their normal lives, they never bother because they've got all of this other stuff that's so much better. So you can train them to get to the odors, but that's not what they do normally. And that's a kind of relief because otherwise you'd have to figure out how these various birds that, for example, grow up on a small peninsula in Alaska fly day and night 11,000 miles with no stops for food across the Pacific the first time as birds only a few months old and wind up in, say, French Polynesia if you come from one habitat or if you come from the other habitat. They wind up in the Marshall Islands. It's a lot easier to explain if, in fact, they have calibrated themselves to the Earth's magnetic field and they just set off looking for a set of coordinates that are going to be out there.
Now, we've mentioned magnetic fields a couple of times. How does that actually work?
I'm as guilty as anyone for oversimplifying nature here. The assumption was that there would be a magnetic field detector, and initially it was going to serve as a compass. It's only later, the early 80s, that it became clear to some of us that the map had to depend on magnetic cues as well. But initially, people just worried about the compass. And a little bit of work here in my lab turned up magnetite, which is lodestone, the natural compass that the original compass needles were made from, there was lodestone. There were lots of little magnets in bees and homing pigeons in very localized areas. And that seemed like, obviously, what they were going to use as their compasses. But again, as I say, I was guilty of oversimplifying nature. It turns out that, at least in birds, there's a second magnetic field detector, just like there's a second clock hidden away there. There's a second magnetic field detector, and it's located in the eye, and it doesn't depend on magnetite at all. It depends on superparamagnetic interactions with the Earth's field using a pigment called cryptochrome that's found in the eye. Now, I remember when my colleagues and I were first proposing our magnetic map hypothesis, we explained that a compass, even based on paramagnetic materials, were really foolish choice for evolution because it can't detect the difference between north and south. It can only tell you the dip angle, the angle that the field lines go into the Earth. Well, son of a gun, if these silly birds don't have this paramagnetic detector in their eye, and in fact can't tell the difference between north and south except by the angle of the Earth's magnetic field into the ground. So a variety of animals, some reptiles, essentially all birds as far as we know, but that's it, not mammals, not others. There's some evidence in insects, but it's pretty equivocal, have this pigment-based system for their compass, but for the map, they use the magnetite. Other animals, both the map and the compass are magnetite. So things were much more complicated than we thought. But anyway, the point is that if you go looking for the compass and think you've got the map, you are likely to be wrong.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with James Gould, co-author of the book Nature's Compass, The Mystery of Animal Navigation. Well, now people have claimed that they can feel or are sensitive to magnetic fields, and you actually did some research on that as well.
Yes, there was a researcher in Britain, Robin Baker, who did experiments with humans and seemed to find that humans could home. That is, you could take them out in a vehicle and ask them which way home was, and they were more likely to point the right direction than not. And if you made them wear magnets, they weren't as good. And this, at the time, we were all just awestruck at the simplicity of this technique. How could we have missed this? And all of this would explain so much, and it was just wonderful until we tried repeating it. And it turns out that when we repeat this sort of thing in the U.S., we take the idea of circuitous routes seriously and make the routes circuitous, and we take the idea of sensory deprivation seriously and block the windows of the bus and so on. And I was appalled to discover that Baker left the windows open so the sun could stream in, and anybody with half a brain could figure out which direction the sun was in. And their circuitous route consisted of making a couple of turns between the start point and the stop point. When you do this and are a little more serious about the controls, the students just have no idea where they are. So we invited Baker over to show us what we were doing wrong, and but he was still required to cover the windows of the bus with aluminum foil and to put a couple of good trips around the traffic circle in the route. And sure enough, none of the students could do it, even when he was running the experiment. So we think that the original results were just humans being smarter than the experimenter, perhaps. Or alternatively, it could be that those of us in the New World really are much less well-oriented than those in Britain. Although attempts to repeat this in Britain have not worked either, so I don't think that's the answer. I think humans just really aren't very good. And if we look at the animals that are, they are generally, not always, they are generally creatures that really need to move over long distances relative to the quality of their eyesight. And our ancestors were simply not in that situation. They lived in tropical rainforests with small home ranges and depended very much on visual cues to get from one banana tree to another. So perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. Also, if you go through looking for the magnetite compass, it's not there. If you start looking for the cryptochrome in the eyes, that's not there. We don't seem to have the equipment for doing it either. There are mammals that do, but just not us.
So just to sort of clarify now, is all of what we've been talking about scientific consensus at this point? Because it was very controversial for quite a while.
Oh, yes. Well, there are still people that don't want it to be magnetic. And I think they've pretty much had to give up on migrating animals. The experiment in which you simply take a sea turtle or a lobster or a newt and put it in a box and dial in you know, Little Rock, Arkansas, and see them turn and head that direction. That's pretty difficult to get around. That is a direct experiment that is its own control. Pigeons are another matter. No flying bird has been trained to do this orientation trick without actually flying. And once they're flying, you can't control the magnetic field. So it's still possible to entertain the idea that birds are different from all these other animals, and that they really are using odors or Coriolis force or ESP or what have you. But you know, when you look at the pigeon data and you see all the things that small changes in the Earth's magnetic field, too small to affect the compass, things like magnetic storms and magnetic anomalies in the ground and so on, these things have huge effects on the bird's ability to know where it is. I really think the smart money is that it's going to be turn out that pigeons and Arctic terns and all the rest of the migrating birds are using the same trick that we see in sea turtles and the other animals that are more experimentally convenient.
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm joined by James Gould, co-author of the book Nature's Compass, The Mystery of Animal Navigation. Now, your last chapter of this book was interesting. It was talking about sort of the future of migration, especially under the fear of climate change. So maybe just tell us about that.
Well, originally I had assumed that climate change was just going to doom many species to extinction. But the good news is that there's a lot of flexibility built in, both in terms of genetic variability, so that even all the birds of a population now disagree somewhat on how far to go and exactly what direction, and that allows them to discover new habitats, start a little early, fly a little further, and so on. That's allowing birds to, the ones that are programmed genetically to start earlier or go further or what have you, are the ones that are going to leave more offspring than the ones that, in Darwin's lottery, did not get the winning ticket. So while it's bad news for some parts of the population, it's always bad news for some parts. It's just a different part of the population is now getting the short straws. So that was good news. And there's also, it turns out, a great deal of phenotypic adaptability in which the birds, if the weather gets warmer earlier, they can simply start earlier. There's not a huge flexibility there. We're talking a few days or a few weeks. But nevertheless, it's significant, and of course, combined with genetics, means that they have a better chance of surviving. Also, the question of how far to go, whether to migrate or all this turns out to have, in many species, a lot of noise. And that noise is the hope for the future. It's the noise that allowed them to survive the last ice age and all the many, many changes. If you look in that last chapter and just look at temperature in over the past 600 million years, it's amazing anything's alive now. The challenge we have now, the amount of temperature change is trivial compared to what animals have been through. The rate of change, however, is not. And that's why they need this this flexibility. Now, the species I worry about are the ones that spend the winter in the tropics, because the tropics are not providing the cues that say you ought to start early this year. The tropics are the one part of the world, well, other than about half of Antarctica, the one part of the world that's not getting warmer. And so they're not getting cues that say the food is going to be available a month early up north. But for birds that are in the, you know, the semi-tropics or in the temperate zone, they get the message, and they typically get started earlier. Another bit of phenotypic plasticity is that birds typically do not fly 11,000 miles like our birds from Alaska, but typically fly a comfortable distance and then stop and feed. And the pattern in the past has been that you fly a couple of hundred miles and you stop and you you feed for a few days and then you start up again. But now, because the spring is a little bit earlier, they don't have to stop for as long because there's more food already there. Now, the big worry is habitat loss. It's flying at the right time and in the right direction and discovering that the forest that used to feed you en route is no longer there. That's, I think, what's going to be a serious problem for these birds, and it's a serious problem already, but it's only going to get worse. So I think that's, people like to blame the climate for things, but I think here we can just blame ourselves a lot more directly. It's happening quickly, and it's difficult to see really what to do about it, because people are not going to say, oh, golly, those birds are such sweet things. I'm going to abandon my farm and my livelihood so that they can feed twice a year on their way north and south. That seems unlikely. And so I think there will be a shift in the species composition that makes it north and south, depending on which habitats disappear en route. I think that's the big thing you're going to see.
Well, on that depressing note, James, wonderful.
There will be winners. I mean, remember, there are always winners. It's just we tend to focus on the losers.
That wasn't any happier. James, it was really good to have you with us.
Nice to speak to you.
You can find James Gould, co-author with Carol Grant Gould, of Nature's Compass, The Mystery of Animal Navigation, at the link on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. Next up on Skeptically Speaking, some recent research on crow cognition with anthropologist Greg Leiden. Stay tuned.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the ways that people are changing the planet and the consequences for all of us if we don't start doing it responsibly. We're joined by Fred Gutterl, executive editor at Scientific American, to discuss his book, The Fate of the Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It. From climate change to drug-resistant superbugs, we'll talk about the ways humanity could take itself out and how and if we can stop it before it's too late. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
This is Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Greg Layden, anthropologist and blogger at Greg Layden's blog at Science Blogs. Always good to have you here, sir.
Great to see you.
So I'd like to talk about the research that's recently been published about the New Caledonian crows, the research that may suggest that crows are capable of complex cognition. Can you start by laying out exactly how their experiment was set up?
Yeah, this is an experiment done with Corvus monodeloides, which is a crow that lives in New Caledonia and the Loyalty Islands in the Pacific. This is something that follows a long series of research projects done by Alex Taylor and Russell Gray of Auckland, University of Auckland, and Rachel Miller of the University of Vienna. And these crows are well known to be smart. They do things like they drop snails on rocks to break them open. And they use several kinds of tools in the wild. So the idea was to test for the idea that these crows could understand something about causal agents, or more specifically, hidden causal agents. So this is like you experience something and you know that there's a cause and an effect, but you don't necessarily know what the cause is. So you may be curious about it, you may investigate, you may be uncertain about it. But the idea is, can a crow understand that there can be causes that they know about and causes that they don't know about? So the way they set up the experiment basically was to have a box that the crow kind of had to stick its head into to manipulate some stuff to get some food. And in so doing, its tail end had to be pointed towards a stick that was sort of sticking out of a wall. These are wild crows brought into an enclosure, but they're a little bit used to humans. So that the first few times the crows come down to eat, a person stands there and moves a stick around in sort of a menacing fashion, but not really poking the crow, just moves it around. And the crows don't like that. They stay away from the food. But after a little while, they realize it's just a human. It's just a stick. The stick is moving because the human's moving it. This is a bit weird, but I can go eat anyway. So the crows get used to eating with a human doing this strange thing. But then at another time, the crows go to eat and the stick is moving because of a secret magnetic device or something they've got stuck in there. They make the stick move for no apparent reason. It's being moved by a causal agent that is hidden and is not knowable to the crows. And this freaks them out. They spend less time trying to get at the food. They stare at the stick more. They keep turning around and looking at it, or they just simply won't even go near it. They understand the difference between the same exact thing happening, the stick moving in the same exact way, with an explanation that is, to them, benign, once they're used to it, versus it's no explanation, and it's just a spooky, weird thing that's happening, and they don't like that.
So, I guess, in effect, crows are reacting to those hidden causal agents in the same ways that humans do.
Similar. Now, in order for them to be acting just like a human, they would eventually have to take, you know, that they can make tools out of leaves and they can make tools out of sticks. To be human, like, they'd have to take the leaves and make altars and pray to the stick.
Noted.
Well, this is actually one of the ideas the researchers are working on, is that hidden causal agents are things that we as humans experience when we don't know the explanation for something and we invent explanations. And those could be beliefs about superstition or religion and that kind of thing.
But they're on the same path.
They're on the same path.
So how might they have developed that ability then?
It's interesting because they live in a well-mature and well-developed rainforest in a relatively rugged terrain, which means that there's a lot of, in that kind of environment, things are very cryptic. You can't find things very easily. You don't see things. The predator that eats you is something you're not going to see coming. It'll be a snake behind some leaves, it'll be something sneaking up on you. So the idea is if the crows perceive something moving, like branches and leaves, without a known hidden agent, it's probably something that eats crows. So they're adapted to, they're sensitive to that. Now, the problem with that is they may be simply very automatically nervous about anything where they can't see what's causing a movement.
Right.
Which implies possibly an ability to understand the difference between inanimate and animate objects. I was just actually talking to Alex Taylor the other day about this, and that's what they're working on next. They're going to test a key prediction of this Quayle's reasoning hypothesis, which is that, you know, can crows make correct predictions about inanimate versus animate objects, what they should do? Can they understand that a rock can't make a stick move, but a human can?
So do all birds react in some way like this, and crows are just more advanced then?
Probably not. Birds are extremely diverse. And using Stephen Gould's term, diverse simply means there's lots of species. He would use the term disparate. They're really different from each other. Even though they all kind of seem similar to us, they're really extremely different from each other. And when people have tried to do cognitive research on different species of birds, they have found great, enormous differences between them. So crows are different than other relatively similar birds that they're kind of related to. And within crows, these guys are much more extreme than other birds. And also, I just want to emphasize the fact that since they live in a very close cryptic rainforest, some of their abilities may be because of that environment that they live in. And very little research gets done on animals that are hard to find or that are hard to keep or that aren't already in labs available. So it may be that the animals that have been used in research are not the best selection. If you want to go out and find the best, smartest birds out there, the ones that have been available for people to research on may not be that exact same set of birds. Now, of course, remember Alex the parrot. African gray parrots have exhibited all kinds of amazing behaviors. Economists have yet to discover the actual differences between human consumers and pigeons. They seem to be pretty much the same as far as decision-making abilities. So there's a lot of smart birds, but across the bird world, there's an awful lot of variation. But having said that, bird brains are different than mammal brains. And birds probably in many ways have to be smarter than mammals because they live in a three-dimensional environment. They're relatively vulnerable. They don't have buffers. Humans are fairly typical of other mammals in that we can starve for several days. We can even go without water, even though it's not good. We can go without water for several days. We are able to take all kinds of abuse, and birds can't. Birds, if they go for a couple of days without food, they die of hypothermia, depending on the species, but that's pretty much true. Being flying animals, they're on the edge, and they're vulnerable. And maybe intelligence is sort of a little bit more needed. And birds are actually able, in some species, to grow and resorb parts of their brains as they need them. So the singing parts of singing passerine males, is the parts of the brains that are used for singing in some, at least some species, grow and expand during the season that they're doing all that singing, and then they kind of tuck them away and resorb them at other times. So their brains work differently than ours. Their neural systems in their brains work very differently than ours. So it might be the case that birds generally are much more efficient in the way their brains work. They might be able to get a lot more computing power in a bird brain than the equivalent size mammal brain.
This is Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking about crow cognition with science blogger and anthropologist Greg Layden. Now, Jim Gould pointed out in the last interview that every time a bird shows some kind of advanced abilities of really any kind, scientists make an excuse for why that ability wasn't actually advanced in the first place. So would you agree with that?
I agree that people tend to do that. I mean, I think if you asked Alex Taylor and other bird researchers about this, they would not be doing that. They actually think the birds are pretty amazing. So it's not the scientists that are doing the research on the birds that are saying that.
Right.
But it's more the general community of people who talk about these things. It's true generally, and has been for some time, that when primates or birds or anything else are discovered to do something that's fairly human, or when they come do something that's interesting and advanced in complexity, that we tend to downplay it. I think that humans, in fact, there's a famous video I just happened to watch the other day of Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about how humans have never communicated successfully with any other organism on our planet. And if we're so smart, how come we haven't been able to do that? I think we have to view humans as being very unique in that we have language. Whether you think language is closely tied to thinking, which I think it is, or less tied, which some people think, it's fairly unique and pretty high-powered stuff that we can do, but it's extremely specialized. It doesn't actually allow us to communicate with non-linguistic organisms at all. It only works for communicating with other linguistic organisms, and that's only other humans. So we value our abilities focused on this one thing we do, and we do it very well, but it doesn't have any purpose outside of our species. And it's probably true that among other organisms, there's a lot of communication that happens, a lot of communication happens that goes between species.
So do humans appear to be avoiding acknowledging the possibility of complex cognition in animals?
Yes.
Okay. So why is that?
humans are kind of almost bimodal. Some humans see complex cognition and complex emotional states and things in their cats and dogs and in, you know, other animals that probably aren't there at all. And other people want to attribute no complexity of anything going on in the brain, whether it's thought, emotion, or whatever, to any animals. It's very convenient to avoid attributing any kind of quote-unquote higher function, where higher means closer to humans, which is a bit of a fallacy itself. But it's hard to accept that if you're eating them.
Right.
We have made mistakes by anthropomorphizing other organisms. They are not humans. And we giving them human attributes, it takes away their uniqueness and you make inappropriate assumptions about them. So we have a rule against anthropomorphizing things in our academic discourse. But that is taken by some to mean if there is a quality that we identify in humans, it can't be found in an animal. And that's ridiculous because we are also animals and we are related to some of these animals and we should share some qualities. And we are living on the same planet, which has similar properties everywhere. And we probably share properties with other organisms that are especially diurnal and visual, omnivorous, that sort of thing. And avoiding anthropomorphizing animals, leading to attributing no human capacities or characteristics whatsoever to animals, is just as wrong. Because organisms on this planet, either by coincidence and convergence or by common ancestry, probably share lots of characteristics.
So what does all this mean then, beyond, I guess, realizing that crows are geniuses and humans really enjoy their special snowflake status? What does all this research mean?
One thing it helps us understand, just as if you want to understand human physiology or human digestive processes or, you know, human locomotion, one way to do that is to look at it comparatively. Compare across a range of mammals or animals in general that you know about that allow us to contextualize what we're studying. So with respect to understanding ourselves better, any kind of comparative study is useful. And it turns out that when you find organisms like this, I mean, we might ask the question, how do humans address hidden causal agents? Do six-month-olds know about it? And do two-year-olds know about it? How do they react? Are they like these birds? And so humans have a developmental trajectory in which we show varying abilities to understand or address hidden causal agents. And it shapes our behavior and somewhat our culture, apparently. And by understanding a concept like hidden causal agents or other concepts like theory of mind, that sort of thing, across a range of organisms that have brains, it helps us understand those basic principles of behavior generally. To me, that's the main reason to do this research. In a broader philosophical sense, I think it's all very problematic to try to figure out what it means. Does it mean that if we're less different, that we need to share some of our rights that we give ourselves with other animals? That kind of large-scale philosophical question. I don't know if this crow research really addresses that too directly, you know, because you're always going to find more differences between crows and humans. You're going to find similarities. And that's true with any sort of non-human animal. That's why, you know, humans are a very unique species, and so are the crows, and so are the parrots, and so are everything else. Everything is very unique. That's why they're different species. So finding similarities is probably best viewed as meaningful or useful when we're doing comparative studies across many species. And frankly, I would like to see these experiments that are being done with the New Caledonian crows. I would love to see those experiments replicated with a larger number of related birds.
Actually, that's what the article said, is that they were going to try this using other birds.
We should look forward to that.
And again, thank you so much, Greg, for the chat.
Thank you.
We've linked to Greg Layden of Greg Layden's blog on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Since you're there, why not click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, and be the first to hear about show updates. You could also click over to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our studio assistants are Helen Cavillion and Chelsea Butler.
Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician. The show is edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.